Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time. And today is August 11th and it is, of course, a Friday. So it is the big picture audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, this week has been all about the VIX index. It has done something this week that it hasn't done since the end of last year, and that is that it has posted a higher high. And that is a measure of how much, rather than really how much of a move that we've seen in markets, but rather it is a reflection of how inert the environment has been. Something that we see with, for example, when you calculate an RSI or a stochastic measurement, is that the reading is often influenced by what kind of data goes into the measurement. And when you have a very inert range and it has been very tight in terms of the trading band, then when you get the breakout, it's a large move relative to the very tight environment, and then you can see that the reading goes oversold or overbought very, very quickly, and then it can stay overbought for longer than people are used to because the previous trading environment was so inert. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the price has gone up hundreds of percent, but rather that the size of the breakout is much larger relative to the inertness of the range. And we're getting something like that in the VIX index. It's a big move on the VIX. It certainly stands out on the weekly chart, and it has a dynamic feel to it. It certainly looks like it's a big move, and it has made this new high, and that's supportive of the view that we are in a corrective environment. But when we look at the S&P 500 itself, then certainly, yes, we had a big pullback yesterday, and the current price is at 24.43, and the high back on the 8th was at 24.90. So we've had a reaction of just less than 50 points. The reaction in June was about 50 points. The reaction in May was about 50 points. Between March and April, it was somewhat larger. It was probably about 80 points. The one that we had in between December and February was about 70 points. What we can say then is that the size of the reactions has been getting smaller. That's reflective of an imbalance between supply and demand, a widening imbalance between supply and demand. But when we look at the longer term chart, then we can see that on occasion over the last decade it has pulled back and has overshot the region of the moving average. The price is currently around, well, back at the high this week, the price was about 5% overextended relative to the trend mean. And that's really not very much when we consider that this is an index which has gone from 666 to almost 2500 in the space of 8 years. So this has been a powerful advance. And more importantly, the progression of high reaction lows remains intact. When we are thinking about the size of the reaction being 50 points, this is a very, very short-term consideration. And that would suggest that if it bounces additionally from here and this reaction holds, then this would be another one of these very tight ranges. Could the market pull back by 5%? Could there be an additional uptick in the geopolitical tensions or that we've seen over the last week that could manifest itself into a reaction of more than 50 points? Absolutely. That is certainly the case. Could we see the progression of higher reaction lows that have been held since the March-April pullback broken? Well, that would certainly be that could be a potential outcome if we are in a mean reversion environment. But even in a mean reversion environment, the potential is that we get a reaction back towards the mean, which is at this stage, having already pulled back by 50 points, or just about 50 points, is only about 100 points away. But 100 points on a 2400 point index, again, is not a very large move. So when we look at it in those rational terms, then and compare that to the rather emotional commentary that we're getting in the financial media, certainly we can conclude that we are in a risk-off environment, that there is the argument that we could have an additional pullback in here, and that it is being led lower by, on one side, the retailers, which have got some rather profound challenges to their business models, and also by those shares that were most susceptible to a pullback, and those are the ones that were most overextended on the upside relative to their respective trend means. When we look at the consistency of the advance, as long as it finds support in the region of the trend mean, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the medium-term upside. Now, when we think about the VIX index, in order for a much larger reaction, then the index would have to be surging higher. And certainly there is the possibility of that, but it would probably require a catalyst. And I think everyone is currently focusing on the brinksmanship that is going on with North Korea, because we have two rather colorful characters trying to outdo one another in terms of the most bombastic statement that they can make. But it is in nobody's interest that this situation deteriorate into military conflict. And certainly, it is to be hoped that calmer heads will prevail. And that's particularly the case when the question of exactly what it is that the US can hope to achieve based on what their resources are and the risk to human life that from a North Korean attack on Seoul. There are a lot of moving parts, and it is most likely that this is a situation that is going to be resolved at, or at least peter out and move off the front page. What I'm perhaps more interested in watching is Venezuela. The domestic market has been surging higher, and the reason for that is because stock markets reflect the inflation rate, and we have hyperinflation in Venezuela right now. And you have an administration that has got unabashed dictatorial ambitions. They put down an uprising in the military, a small one this week, and there is the potential for additional upsets in that regime. Now, you don't have collective bargaining agreements in sovereign debt, and Venezuela obviously is a major oil producer. One thing that could act as a problem for Venezuela is the oil price. Now, oil prices pulled back sharply yesterday, but they are back above, back off the low in here today. We're in the region of the progression of lower rally highs evident since January, within what has been a very volatile range. And as long as today's low holds, then this remains a market where we can probably give the benefit of the doubt to higher to lateral ranging. That's not particularly bad news for the Venezuelan oil company. But what I want to do is to look at one of their bonds. I'm not going to pick one of these sinkable bonds. I'll pick a bullet bond because that gives us perhaps a better insight, and it certainly makes the yield calculation less complicated by other factors. So this is the 5 3/8 of 2027, and if we look at the yield chart over the last 5 years, then we can see that certainly the yield is high. It's around 23%, but it has been higher. So, despite the fact that the situation in Venezuela is getting worse, the fact that oil prices have improved and that the dollar is weaker is all to the benefit for a company like this. On the other hand, if, for example, oil prices deteriorate in a meaningful way from these levels, then that could put some quite severe pressure on a company like PDVSA. And I think that that is a more clear and present challenge to the generally bullish environment that we have in stock markets, despite the fact that we are in a short-term corrective phase right now. I think that the most likely scenario is that we do get some pause and consolidation in stock markets, but that and certainly part of the reason for that is because we're in the teeth of the silly season, and that a lot of people are on holiday, and market liquidity has deteriorated. So if one wants to express a bearish view, then there is less, or I guess there is less of an impetus to be fully committed, and not least because a lot of people are out of the office. I saw a number of reports across my desk over the last few days with people saying I'm heading off on holiday, and usually things happen when I'm on holiday, but there's nothing I can do about it. So, and I remember that I cut my teeth in Fuller Money back in 2004 because David used to take a month off and cycle from Land's End to John O'Groats and back again, and you could do that in 2004 because the market moved somewhat slower. Whereas now we have quantitative trading and computer programs that don't take breaks, and they're looking for pauses in the market to express their views, and we're certainly beginning to see some of that. So I think that there is the risk here that we do get an additional pause and consolidation. What, of course, then, what are people looking at in terms of safe havens? Well, the gold price has firmed additionally in here today, and it is coming up towards this $1,300 area. And it has raced to get from $1,250 to $1,300, and that has been an area of resistance since April. So there is the potential that we get some pause and consolidation in this area. If it can clear the $1,300 area, then that would suggest that we are back in a demand-dominated environment. Silver prices were able to get back above the $17 area yesterday, and they have more or less been able to hold that advance in here today. And platinum prices have been firming from the region of the trend mean over the last week, and are back up towards coming back up towards this psychological $1,000 level. So if platinum can surmount the $1,000 level, and more importantly, hold it, like because it was able to do that in January of this year, but then it didn't hold it. Then we can conclude we're back in a demand-dominated environment. But there are two things that I've been thinking about. One is the trend in ETF holdings. ETF holdings of gold surged higher in 2016, and that was off the back of gold rallying off of a pretty depressed level and breaking the medium-term downtrend. And the fact that the high was at 70 million ounces and it's currently around 66 million suggests that a lot of the people who bought gold back in 2016 have held on to it. But there isn't any great sign that they are rushing back in at this particular moment. And that to me raises some questions. One, I guess, is it that gold prices need to clearly move above $1,300 to catalyze investors to really get the their bullish fervor moving once more to get back into this market? Or is that demand for a safe haven being sapped by other assets? Because one thing that we have certainly seen over the last week is that Bitcoin has been breaking up and out of a pretty well-defined range and then improving upon that performance in here today. So Bitcoin has got a number of the same kind of safe haven attributes of gold, that it is in limited supply. It is outside of the ability of governments to print, and it doesn't represent anybody's liability. So then, of course, there will be obvious arguments of people saying, well, then it's worthless, that it isn't something that one can hold. Well, you can certainly hold gold, so there's no question of that. But gold, just like any other asset, is only worth what someone else is willing to pay for it. And in that regard, it is a function of faith in its market. The fact that Bitcoin has gone through the hard fork question and come out the other end in robust fashion is a vote in its favor. The fact that there are steps being taken to improve the The strength of its network and the speed of transactions is certainly an additional it's an additional point in its favor. And certainly there are a lot of young people who look on it as a reflection of the digital economy and the fact that people want to have a digital asset to reflect the strength and continued growth of the digital economy. So that is an additional reason why they are buying it. Whereas then other people would like gold because it's a reflection of the extractive industry. But if we think about what the future is and the evolution of technology and the pace with which things are changing, then the argument for having a digital asset then also having one's investments focused on the digital economy rather than the extractive economy over the long term certainly has merit. When we look at the Dow Gold ratio, then I think that that helps to really paint this picture. We've got over 100 years of history, and it's not quite shown all of it on this particular chart. What we're given is this long-term cycle, and that as equity markets and the corporate sector has evolved over time, their outperformance relative to gold has got progressively larger. And I think that it stands out very clearly that there have been successive higher highs. There was a meaningful low back in 2011 when gold pulled back, and certainly that we have had an impressive move since. In fact, the ratio has almost doubled. That's rather important that that equities relative to gold have just about doubled since 2011, and the if this is if to the low in 2011 was the low, then there is the realistic potential that this ratio is going to trend back up, and it is going to make a new high above 40. In fact, since the first peak in 1929 was around 16, and the next peak was around 26, and the next peak was around 41, 42, then it isn't unreasonable to think that the next time we get a major acceleration in equity prices, where there is unabashed enthusiasm for the new economy, then the potential is that it's going to happen sometime in the 2030s, by which time we could, and if we are thinking about that long-term time horizon, then isn't it also interesting that when you talk about I guess what is the best word to put it in, the penetration of electric vehicles, of the evolution of battery technology, the enhancements that we're seeing in artificial technology, the evolution of not just CRISPR gene editing technology, but synthetic biology, where we're seeing people actually writing DNA code using machines to do that. News this week that even the first malware has been created for genetic code. And if we start thinking about how long is it going to take, not just for commercialization and the early stages of these things to enter the market, we're already there, but for them to become completely dominant, then we are talking about the 2030s, that it does take about 10 years for a brand new technology to completely take over. That's the kind of thing that will create incredible fervor, and it could see this ratio at significant new highs. Now, what I think personally is that we have already had, and I think then this is really a wonderful example of the fractal nature of markets, that when we think about the short term, we're only talking about 50 and 80 point pullbacks on the S&P 500. When we start to think about medium term moves, then we've had a medium term bull market from 2009. That's already 8 years. And what we're seeing now is that the return to outperformance of cyclicals. And that generally tells us that we are in the latter stages of a cyclical bull market. But considering that it is 8 years and counting, then who's to say that it doesn't go on for 10 years or 11 years? When we say we're in the latter stages, if there are three stages, then we are in the latter third of this cyclical advance. Now, this is the FTSE 350 mining index, and it has bounced pretty emphatically. It pulled back this week, certainly from the region of its peak back in January, but this remains a recovery trajectory. The most important thing it's done is broken that medium-term downtrend last year, and this remains a recovery story. Now, then if we think about if this is indicative of the latter stages of a cyclical advance, then cyclical sectors should be doing well. We have synchronized global economic expansion. We still have very low interest rates. And that really is a Goldilocks scenario for the types of companies that are leveraged to global economic growth. And that should be a reasonably benign environment. Now, what we also have is government bond yields that are still really quite low. And if we look at the US 10-year Treasury yield over the last decade, then yields today are exactly where they were in 2008 at the low during the credit crisis. Base formation development is well underway. What base formation development is characterized by is failed breaks. And we had a failed downside break last year. So the yield is currently about mid-range, and a sustained move above 3%, and perhaps more importantly 4%, would really be required to confirm that we are back in a supply-dominated environment. We haven't had a secular supply-dominated environment in bonds for over 35 years. So it would be a profound change. It would be something that would be really a massive change in terms of how the market is set up. Considering that because yields have been so low, there has been a large issuance of bonds. And issuance of bonds in and of itself is not a problem, because the cost of servicing that debt is generally not that challenging for companies. Where the potential problems start to arise is when the debt needs to be refinanced. When we think about all of the debt that's outstanding, then generally speaking, what companies tend to do is refinance their debt rather than pay it down. Paying down debt requires a very strong balance sheet to be able to do that. And generally speaking, they'll go for a refinance. But in the event that yields begin to rise, then that is going to hold out the prospect that it is going to be more difficult or more expensive, to be more accurate, to refinance that debt. I think that's where you begin to have problems in the debt markets. Now, when we think then, just go back to that point, the fractal point about markets. Right now, we're seeing the cyclical part of the market doing better. And generally speaking, cyclicals do not lead, and it is quite likely that they will be among the sector to peak last in terms of this cyclical advance. When we think about what the risks are, I think that there is the potential again that we could have a mean reversion move, and maybe we have more than that. Then there is also the potential that people are starting to price in the potential for a recession, and the yield curve spread does not suggest there's going to be a recession anytime soon. This spread would have to go below zero to really indicate that there is going to be a recession, and then it is a significant lead indicator. So then that would also act as something that would suggest that we are not about to have a recession. When we look at corporate profits, then they are still close to their highs. Margin debt is elevated, but it is not pulling back in a dynamic manner. And as long as all of those things remain the case, or that oil prices are not surging higher, that they're not back at $100, $150, then the likelihood is that we're not about to have a recession this year. We're unlikely to have a recession even in the first half of next year. So that it suggests that the likelihood is that the within the cyclical bull market, we are in the short term in for a pullback. In the medium term, that at some point we are going to have a recession, and it is out there on the horizon, at least a year, even 18 months out, and potentially considerably more than that. It could be 3 years away. But in the context of the secular bull market, then a pullback on a medium-term trend represents a phenomenal buying opportunity if we then go back and think about what the upside is in the Dow gold ratio. Gold prices, and I'm personally long both silver and platinum because I think that they do have a cyclical potential upside, but I think that the secular bull market is over. So I think that that is quite clear from this ratio. But if we're thinking about where is the potential for upside, then it is in the technological innovation. It is in the rise of the global consumer, and it is in the revolution that we're having in the energy markets. Those are the really big stories, and any one of them on its own in previous cycles would have been enough to drive a secular bull. But what we are having right now is these phenomenal stories evolving in all three. And against that background, we have evolution of financial products. Generally speaking, it is the evolution in financial products helps to fuel that advance. Now, what are they? Well, on the one hand, the invention of quantitative easing is a massive generator of asset price inflation. And the fact that we have extraordinary monetary accommodation is something that we have never seen before. And I think it is reasonable to expect that if central banks make a mistake and try to withdraw the money too quickly, then that is going to cause a problem. But we also know that they are going to be incredibly cautious. So certainly that is certainly something else that we need to monitor. But then we also have the evolution of ETFs. The ETF market has been booming, and then we also have passive investing, and that those two points go hand in hand. The fact that people don't tend to hold their investments, they tend to chop and change their ETF investments, is perhaps part of human nature. But the evolution of passive investing does, I think, support the view of buy and hold. Buy and hold means that people buy, and by buying and not leaving it go, they withdraw supply from the market. And the biggest buy and hold investors have been the corporations themselves. This has been a massive trend over the course of this 8 year advance. But then we also have cryptocurrencies and the evolution of blockchain, which is an additional financial innovation. So there's plenty of evidence of financial innovations that are helping to drive this market, in addition to the secular bull themes that I've outlined previously. And if we think about where are we going to be in 2030, then battery technology, the energy density of batteries doubles between every 5 and 8 years. And there have been a slew of stories about advances being made in solid-state batteries, which remove a liquid electrolyte and replace it with a solid material. That removes the possibility in lithium batteries of them exploding or overheating. And it also improves by a factor of two their energy density. And once those hit the market, and it could be Toyota says it's going to be around 2022. BMW is also working on this technology. GS Yuasa is working on this technology. So it is a race to see who can get their battery on the market first. And of course, Tesla has been credited roundly with achieving something that no other company could do, and that is to make a car, an electric car that people actually aspire to own. That was an emphatic breakout from a 3-year range, and now we're getting the consolidation of that advance. As long as it is holding the $300 area, I don't think there's anybody going to be particularly worried about the potential here for additional upside. Now, but if we think about it out in 2030 and beyond, then electric vehicles, the size of their market share will have multiplied on a number of occasions since then, since now. And batteries will be ubiquitous. There will be batteries for our houses. Our phones will last much longer. We'll have a lot more gadgets that require storage, and the integration of battery storage with solar power in large swathes of the global economy will create a lot more energy. And a lot more energy drives economic growth, and lower energy costs on average, and particularly on an inflation-adjusted basis, remove a headwind from growth. The fact that this technology is being rolled out to the aspiring middle classes in major population centers is creating, minting millions of new consumers, and they aspire to the standard of living that we take for granted. And that is, and the rollout, for example, of 4G in India, in certain large parts of Africa, and the evolution of the online economy, not just because of Amazon, but because of the ease of use and the intuitive way that it's used, that you can give a 1-year-old a smartphone and they can figure out how to swipe and tap pretty intuitively. That isn't because 1-year-olds are particularly intelligent, but rather that because the software is so intuitive, and that has that's in an incredible innovation for the hundreds of millions of people who are illiterate in this world, and they are now being able to, for the first time, gain real access to the global economy. And that's the kind of thing that really helps to drive a secular bull market. Now, the rise of automation, the rise of artificial intelligence, that is also going to drive a dynamic move in the cost of manufacturing. Because if energy prices are coming down, and if automation increases, then that is also going to require fewer workers. That also means that the size of domestic economies is going to have to increase. Domestic demand is going to be a major growth market. That is why China has been so intent on driving that. India already has a dynamic internal consumer market, and major population centers like Europe and North America are well on their way as well. It means that the global supply chain network is probably going to become more localized on a continental basis, and it is going to be driven by fast runs. Customization is going to become a much more important theme. And the way that I tend to think of it, or at least the way that is easiest to comprehend, is to think about the Edwardian or Victorian gentleman, or Downton Abbey. Who is the person whose life you would most like to have on Downton Abbey? Well, it is the Lord of the Manor. And that is the standard of living that can be approximated with the evolution of technology. But instead of replacing or achieving that standard of living with many minions serving one, then those people will be replaced by robots and with apps, most particularly. And that is, I think, the probably the way that the evolution of artificial intelligence and robotics is going to affect the consumer experience. So I think that that is how we're going to have it unfold, that standards of living and the approximation of a lord or a nobleman in Victorian England or in Edwardian England is perhaps how we can best contemplate what the outcome is of this technological innovation. And that represents the I guess the utilitization of cash flows, that the way that the economy is evolving is that, and we can see it with Netflix and Amazon and all the subscription businesses that are evolving now, that they want to capture a percentage of an individual's cash flow in order to live a what will be considered a normal standard of living, then one is going to have a certain amount of cash flow. And how products can be bundled together and how the consumer experience can evolve, that is all going to be dictated by artificial technology apps and customized and local manufacturing. And I think that that is the way that it is already beginning to roll out in the developed market, and that it is already rolling out in places like China. So I think that when we think about where are we in terms of this evolution, we're still in the early stages. That it could be 20 years before we get to a point where the change is really noticeable. And by that stage, when it is evident, when we have the evidence behind us that it is possible, then that is when you get the really excited acceleration. But of course, and I've written about this today, it is almost like Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. It is the more that you know about the trajectory of the particle, the less you know about its position. And the more you know about the bullish story, well, the less likely it is that that is going to help to transform stock prices, because it is already in the price that eventually what happens is that people anticipate the market. They already know what's happened. They have the evidence behind them that they can see what's happened, and they anticipate what's going to happen next. And then that is when you get prices accelerating higher, and that changes the nature of the market. And that is also when supply increases, and eventually that is what causes the big change, the big crash. But we are nowhere near that. That is, we are, there is no evidence of that kind of ebullient thinking. And not least because we can still talk about the future with uncertainty. That we're looking at these things and saying, well, I believe that this is what's going to happen and that this is what the trajectory is. But it hasn't happened yet. And we've certainly seen that technology-oriented companies have done fantastically well. And certainly there are some that are on valuations that are really rather eccentric. But the reality is that outside of a small number of companies, that and the big stories are really out there only just on the horizon. So I think that in the context of the long-term bull market, we are still in the early stages. That's what the Dow Gold Ratio tells us. Then when we look at markets like India, and not just on the short term, but rather on the really long term, then this is a massive secular bull market. Certainly there is some pause and consolidation going on right now around the 10,000 level. This market has not been updated to the current price. So we're definitely getting some pause around that psychological number, but the long-term trend is up, and considering the size of the market, then it has ample potential for additional upside. Then when we look at some of these really long-term ranges, that the Taiwanese market might have pulled back this week, but It has cleared the 10,000 level. It's at new all-time highs for the first time really since 1997. So this is a profound change. This is the completion of a very lengthy bear market. The South Korean market, despite the uptick in brinksmanship, really doesn't show a great deal of evidence that there's anything really wrong. It's probably reacting more to the potential indictment of the CEO of Samsung than the threat from North Korea. And it has completed a very lengthy range in just the last few months. And even when we look at Europe, which has for much of the last decade been the sick man of the global economy, then the FTSE 100 has cleared the 7,000 level for the first time, and that is the completion of a 17-year range. And when we look, and of course, I think the FTSE is leading the Europe 600, then that is on a reversion back towards the mean. But when we look at that long-term chart, the area around 400 is an awfully big level, and the extent to which it can find support in the region of the trend mean over the next few weeks will give us, I think, some intelligence on how likely it is that it is going to be able to break up and out of that $400 point area over the next while. The South African market also broke up and out of its range over the last few weeks. It has pulled back pretty sharply in here this week, not least because that there is clear evidence that governance is not improving. If it sustains a move below 55,000, it would be a failed upside break, and that would open up the room for a pullback all the way back to 50,000. I think it is also worth considering what we can expect from the dollar over the next few years. We have had a substantial pullback since the presidential election, and but I think the more important thing is that it broke up and out of that pretty lengthy base in the last couple of years. And as long as it is holding the 90-point area, then the most likely scenario is that this is a first step above that base. And that would suggest that we are going to be in for a choppy environment for the dollar. When we look at how China is evolving, it represents a very different way of looking at it, that this is a massive country with a huge population, and the Communist Party represents the status quo and stability, and they have got some significant issues that they're facing in terms of bad loans and corruption, and more importantly, the visibility of corruption because of the evolution of technology. That they are clamping down on all media outlets right now because the Party Congress is coming up, and it's a once in a generation opportunity for Xi to really capture his or to put in his the people that most closely align with his view of the world. They're doing everything they can, including strengthening the currency and putting some, or at least stabilizing the stock market. That's despite the fact that the Hang Seng pulled back pretty sharply in here today. But then they are clamping down very tightly on media outlets. That is eventually going to create an issue, because we are at a point where it is the evolution of both human capital and technological capital is the driving force behind innovation. And the free movement of ideas and people, and most particularly research, is a driver for economic growth. And open economies have got a clear route to doing that. Closed economies, it's more challenging. That's certainly a headwind from the perspective of China. But the fact that they have succeeded in developing a domestic consumer market from basically nothing is a massive testament to what a controlled economy can do, and most particularly when it is at the expense of individual freedoms. And unfortunately, that is something that is an evolving trend. We have countries where governance is clearly improving, and we have countries where governance is not improving. The status quo in China has contributed to a very choppy environment on their stock market, and that is, I think, a reflection of how much they are tightening up. That they're tightening up in some parts of the economy, but they're getting success in others. And so far, that has been something of a give and take, but there is no guarantee that that will remain the case indefinitely. So, what happens after the Party Congress is probably going to give us a lot of information about what we can expect from China over the next few years. Now, I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.